So we've started this series on the Satipatthana, which is often translated as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Now this group, for those of you who are new, is not a Buddhist group. We're a mindfulness meditation group. But as you probably know, a lot of meditation is rooted in Buddhism. And the Satipatthana is one of the primary texts with instructions on how to meditate. So we're looking at it sort of as an instruction manual. The contents of it are not religious. It really is just, this is how you meditate. So last week I gave a sort of overview, looking at the structure of it and a little bit of the history. And as I say, it's often translated as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which people will then assume means the four things on which you build your mindfulness. A better translation is four areas in which to have mindfulness nearby. So it's not a preliminary thing. It's not something you have to do first in order to be mindful. It's areas of experience in which you can apply mindfulness in order to progress down the path. Today, I want to look at the first part of the content. I'll just read the beginning couple of paragraphs again for those who weren't here before. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, meaning the Buddha, was living in the Kuru country at a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks. Venerable sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. So now the Buddha is speaking. Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. And I'm sorry about all of these Pali words. Pali is the language that the Buddha spoke. But some of these words just can't be translated into English very well. So we're going to be looking at those this evening. So this is the direct path for the purification of beings, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. And what are the four? And then he goes on and he lists them in this very typical, repetitious way, which comes about because these were passed down through oral tradition, so they would be repeated. The whole thing is very repetitious, as we'll find. But essentially what he says, the four areas of establishing mindfulness are the body, the feeling tone, so pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, aspect of an experience, mind states, and what's called the dhammas, which we'll get into in a few months, but those are things like the hindrances, being aware when you are sleepy or agitated, and the factors of awakening, so mindfulness and concentration, so these sort of vague things. Essentially, what we're saying is that this is the direct path to nibbana by bringing mindfulness to the body, feeling tone, the mind, and the dhammas. And that's what we're going to be looking at throughout the year. Tonight, I want to look at that first paragraph about the direct path and what that means and what some of those Pali words mean and the direct path to what. What is this? What is the goal of doing this? What is this the path to? So I'll just read that one sentence again. Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. Or those four areas that I just mentioned. So those of you who don't know me will learn soon enough that I love language and looking at roots of words and translations and stuff. And so the first thing to look at is this word that is used for direct path. And depending on the translation that you read, it could mean direct path. It might mean a path that leads directly to the goal. Another translation claims that this is the one and only path to Nibbana. Yet another says this is the path that one must travel alone. Only you can travel it. No one can travel it for you. Another is that this is the path taught by the one, namely the Buddha. Another one is that this is the path found only in Buddhism. I'm not really convinced about that, but that is one way some people translate it. Another translation is that the path leads to one goal, namely Nibbana. So obviously, the translation that you choose to use is going to affect your approach to these instructions. You know, is this the only way to Nibbana, and anything else you do is not going to get you there? Or is this just the Buddhist way and everything else is fine? It's important to understand the different ways it can be translated and to be a little bit open to what that means to you. But I choose to go with the translation by Analio, who wrote this book, which I mentioned last week is the book that I'll be basing a lot of my academic parts of this on. Analio is considered to be one of the main primary experts on this, and he does textual comparisons and such, so I'll be referring to him a lot. And I like his translation. He's chosen the translation of the direct path. Now, the word that we're talking about is a Pali expression. I can't pronounce it very well, but Ikayano Mago, which is made up of three words. It's a combination word. Ika, Ayana, and Maga, which means one, going, and path. So it's literally one going path. So you can see how that might end up being translated in a number of different ways. But Analio has done a lot of comparison with where this phrase is used in other parts of the Pali Canon, which is the bulk, the whole collection of Buddhist texts that this text is part of. And he concludes that it means the direct path in this sense. And this is an example from another place that this phrase is used, in a story in which a man is on a path that ends in a pit. And if the man stays on the path and keeps walking, you can predict that he's going to fall into the pit, right? So it's a direct path in that it will take you to the pit or to Nibbana. Notice that it doesn't say that it's the only way. He can go off the path and come at the pit from another angle and still end up in the pit. And so there are other ways of getting there. This is not the only way. It doesn't even claim to be the best way. It just claims to be a path that if you stick to it, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to end up at the goal. So what is this goal? The direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of Nibbana. So that sounds sort of like a long list, right? Lots of things that are going to happen here. But really, it's just a repetitious list. It's different ways of saying the same thing, was, you know, coming at it from slightly different angles so that it's perfectly clear what's being said. Some of this is pretty clear. Surmounting sorrow and lamentation. Surmounting sorrow and lamentation sounds pretty good, right? That doesn't need a whole lot of explanation. The disappearance of discontent. So this is a path whereby we can get rid of discontent, we can get rid of sorrow. But there are a few other words in here that are a little confusing, so I just want to look at those. And in fact, they all sort of work together to make sense. So the first thing, the purification of all beings. What exactly does that mean? The word dukkha, which is one of those Pali words that doesn't really translate very well into English, and nibbana, which is the Pali pronunciation of the word nirvana. If you speak in Sanskrit, it's nirvana. Sanskrit was a sort of a language, a universal language, but in different regions people spoke different languages that had that were very similar but different. So the Pali texts were written in the language of the Buddha and translated into Sanskrit. So, for example, Dhamma and Dharma are the same word. Nibbana and Nirvana are the same word. So let's look at what that means. Nibbana, dukkha, and the purification of all beings. Because this is what we're going to be aiming for this year. So dukkha is a word that's often translated as suffering, which is a good translation, but it's actually a little more subtle than that. It's more like just a discontent or dissatisfaction. It's described as if you're riding in a cart and one of the wheels of the cart, the hub, is really worn, so it's not rotating smoothly, and you're just driving along sort of with this constant bumping every time the wheel bumps around. That's dukkha. It's that constant onslaught of things just not being as you want them to be. And yes, if you have your arm chopped off in an industrial accident, that is also dukkha. But some of us are fortunate not to have that sort of intense suffering, but we are still dissatisfied because of these little things that are not as we'd like them to be. And that is what's meant by dukkha. We know from other texts, and from some that we'll look at later in the year, that dukkha, this dissatisfaction, is not caused because the wheel is worn. It's caused because of our internal attitude of either grasping on to things that we want or pushing away things that we don't want, or just being deluded about what's going on, thinking that something is one way when it's actually another way. This is traditionally those words, grasping, aversion, and delusion or ignorance, are translated as greed, hatred, and delusion, which I don't typically like because they have baggage with them. But they mean the same thing and they're easier to say, so I might use those interchangeably. So dukkha, this constant dissatisfaction, is caused from an attitude of greed, hatred, and delusion. Purification is mental cleansing of that attitude, those attitudes of greed, hatred, and delusion, from your mind. So this path leads to the cleansing of grasping, aversion, and ignorance, which cause dukkha. So the purification removes the dukkha, right? So this is a path in which we're going to do something that removes our suffering or reduces our suffering. And then the last word, nibbana, literally means blowing out or quenching, like you would blow out a candle or you'd throw water on a fire to quench it. So that's about quenching the suffering or quenching the dukkha. So you can see that all of these phrases in this description here are saying the same thing from slightly different angles. So it's saying that this is the direct path to the end of suffering. Or in short, what I've called our series this year, the path to freedom. Actually, what I've called this series is 53 paths to freedom, because there are four categories that we mentioned: body, feeling, tone, mind, and dhammas. Each of those have subcategories of different techniques of meditation, And I counted them up, and I'm not sure that I'm exactly right, but I think that I counted 53 different meditation techniques in this text that we're studying that is claiming to be the path, a path. So is it 53 paths or is it one path? You know, what's going on here? So if you look at the commentaries, the commentaries were written, I think, about 1,500 years after Buddha. Is that right, John? They were written over a period of time, but they were other Buddhist monks and scholars who wrote commentaries on the earlier texts. And so you can look and see what the commentators had to say. And what the commentators say is that there are so many different categories or so many different techniques because there's so many different kinds of people. And they refer to stories in which the Buddha is teaching different types of people and gives them different types of meditation techniques. So here's a quote from one of the commentaries talking about these different kinds of people in relation to the four categories or the four foundations. So for a dull-witted man of the craving type, the arousing of mindfulness through the contemplation of the gross physical body is the path to purity. But for the keen-witted craving type, the subtle subject of meditation on the feeling is the way. And for the dull-witted man of the theorizing type, the path to purity is arousing mindfulness through a subject not too full of distinctions, namely consciousness. So something sort of that isn't too analytical. But for the keen-witted theorizing type, the subject which seems with distinctions, namely the contemplation of things of the mind or mental objects, is appropriate. And on it goes. So the commentaries are saying that the Buddha is giving us so many different techniques because there's so many different types of people. And from this we can gather that any of the techniques is going to be sufficient. Find one that works for you. You don't have to do all of them. You only need to do one. Find the one that suits you. So I think that's true, and that's what I teach, that you only need one technique to get all the way down the path to freedom. But I think there's also a little more going on here. And that's that these areas of body, feeling, mind, and the dhammas, they all build on each other. So if you start with the body, which involves things like noticing the breath, or noticing your posture, are you standing or sitting or lying down? Those are pretty coarse, obvious things, easy to notice things. So you start off with that, and then you move on to feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, which is a little more subtle than just I'm standing up or I'm sitting down. And then into the mind states, which is a little subtler still. And finally you get to the dhammas, which are really sort of hard to pin down. I mean, it's hard enough to define what the word means. And when we get there, it's going to make a little more sense. But that's a much more subtle thing to be observing. So in a way, you're building on each of these categories. It's like a progression to develop your clarity. But on the other hand, we're supposed to be mindful of everything. So it's not like you can just ignore the other aspects while you're working on one of them. And in fact, you're never done with any of them. Even the most enlightened teachers today do the basic breathing techniques. So they do build on each other, but they also work together and intertwine and inform and reveal and complement each other. So this, the whole thing as a whole blends together into a sort of powerful single thing. And the beauty of it is that you can use one technique, you can use 53 techniques, you can do it in order, you can do it not in order, and somehow that still is the path, not the only path, but a path that will take you to freedom from suffering, if you stick to that path. So that's what we're going to be looking at for the rest of the year, is how to get to freedom, how to surmount lamentation and sorrow. And so I think that's a pretty exciting goal to have.